is that anytime you change management systems, even in a country like New Zealand, where they don't have the tendency to litigate that this country does, everything starts with a lawsuit. And they had to determine the legal basis for a settlement with the indigenous peoples who were named the Maori. And so there was an injunction placed on this immediately until they determined what the Maori's rights were under this plan. And if I could have the next slide, please. The court ruled in 1987 that the Maori did have a very specific right under this plan, and the key part of this long passage is the last sentence. Those fisheries had a commercial element and were not purely recreational or ceremonial, or merely for the sustenance of the local dwellers. And what they specifically did is award the Maori 20% of all the fisheries in the quota management system unless they already could prove it, document through landings that they had higher than a 20% participation in a specific fishery. So, you know, right off the bat, you had basically a skimming of 20% off the top for the indigenous people, and they set up their own corporation and run their own fishery. So once they had that settled, we can kind of get into the history of this a little bit. In 1986, New Zealand was having a major economic crisis. The country was nearly bankrupt. They were about to default on their government obligations. So they voted in a new government, in this case a new political party, and the party brought in economists from Canada, the U.S., as well as other Western countries, to act as consultants to turn the country's economy around. And most of their economy is resource-based. It's natural resources. And it was all heavily subsidized. Didn't matter whether you were in fishing, farming, logging, anything you did, you were getting a payment from the government, and the basic game was to try and get more than you gave. And people were quite successful at it because they were draining the treasury dry. And the fisheries were deemed overfished and on the verge of collapse. The New Zealand fishing fleet was overcapitalized with too many participants. And so the result was they adopted a purely economic model for fisheries management, the quota management system. In 1986, New Zealand adopted and implemented this system. The government has adjusted the system a few times since, but in general, it has been in its current form since inception. Participation was based on catch history. Aggregation limits on the ownership of quota were initially set. And after a few years, the companies that were buying up the quota began to lobby the government and were able to have the aggregation limits changed. So initially they had a law that said no one corporation or entity other than the Maori could own more than 15% of the quota. That number is up to 35% now, and there is a company other than the Maori that's bumping up against that limit, and they expect that will probably be changed shortly. Today, 10 companies own 90% of the quota, and four of those major companies own 72% of the quota. And in this case, when I'm talking about quota, I'm not talking about one species like lobster or red snapper or something like this. This is all the quota in all the fisheries in all of New Zealand. And New Zealand has the fourth largest exclusive economic zone of any country in the world. So we're talking substantial area and volume and species. The quota management system, some points about it. New Zealand exports 90% of the fish landed. They export all over the world, but primarily to Asia. And they keep very little fish for domestic consumption. Most of the processing plants we visited were equal to or exceeded our plants in the U.S. They produce a very high-quality product under very carefully controlled conditions. It's very impressive. Because the industry pays fees on the quota, they are very conscious of the demand efficiency within the government. A lot of their management functions have been privatized. Those that haven't are carefully watched by the people that are basically paying the freight. Demand for efficiency has led to privatization of some government agencies. A lot of people who used to work for what they call MFISH, which is the equivalent of the National Marine Fisheries Service, now work for private corporations that work on quota issues. The industry pays for independent science, data management, and quota management. The industry pays resource rents on their quota and deemed value on quota that goes unused. And deemed value is a complicated concept. We could spend all afternoon discussing it. But basically, the fisheries don't shut down. If you harvest fish and you catch, let's say you're in the red snapper fishery and you catch a lobster, and you don't have any lobster quota, you have to buy lobster quota from somebody because you can't throw the lobster back. And that's when you pay this deemed value on it. And if the lobster quota is all used up, then you pay the government deemed value. But the fisheries still don't shut down. So it's very complicated. We can take questions on it later if people want to discuss it some. Quota owners must always balance their catch to their quota. This is a key concept of the fisheries. So, as I said, if you catch something and you don't have quota for it, you've got to go out and buy it from somebody else. You've got to pay them for the use of their quota. They also have full retention. So if you're you're in a volume fishery and you make a set, there's no throwing anything back. You have to bring it all in. I don't care if you tow it in. They don't care if you drag it in. They don't care if you sink. But you can't throw it back. And if you do throw it back, they have, in New Zealand, again, they operate under a different legal system, but everything in New Zealand has instant fines. That's what they call them. If you bring a banana through customs and you don't tell a customs agent you got a banana, $250 instant fine. No judge, no jury, no nothing. Just fork over the money or else. If you're in the fisheries and you violate the fisheries law, they have $250,000 instant fines. Somebody just comes down and says, you did something wrong. Pay the government $250,000. And there's basically no appeal, no nothing. It's a very different legal system than we operate under. Quota can be purchased or leased from other vessels or processors. And once quota is balanced, the deemed value fee is reimbursed. So they have this complicated system of collecting the money and then redispersing it through both to the quota holders and to the government. As I said, the whole deemed value concept is a very, very complicated system. Next slide, please. It's already there. Oh, I'm sorry. I can't read the slides if I read this. Over $28 million are paid to the government by industry, which is then used for enforcement and implementation of management measures. So you could see that it would be kind of clear that the government would support this. And $28 million as a percentage of their gross income is a very high number. Because the science is fully independent, the scientists present facts and do not recommend policy or management actions. Management actions are left to a management advisory board and the Minister of Fisheries. And this is where the politics enters the system. The Minister of Fisheries is an elected member of Parliament, and he's the one who actually sets the quotas. And since he is an elected official, he can also be unelected if he doesn't set quotas that match what people expect. Openness and clear management goals have helped with the stewardship of the resource and trust in the private agencies. As I said, they have a number of private corporations that kind of administer the day-to-day applications of this system, and they're very open. Their books are open. They're not public companies. I mean, they're not part of the government, but they're public companies, and they have to display all their financial holdings and everything, so it's pretty transparent. The government here has a higher level of authority when it comes to decision-making without lots of public input and objection. New Zealand is by our standard, you might say, a fairly docile country. They're not interested in participation in the public process the way people, at least in New England, are. They're pretty accepting of what the government does. They just basically, from where we sat and the people we talked to, they're along for the ride. Whether they agree with things or not, they just kind of, oh, well, then they let it happen. least that was our perception. It is common practice for the Minister of Fisheries to make broad decisions regarding the tollable, allowable commercial catch following the advice of its advisors and scientists. But there is no specific mandate for them to follow the advice. They are free to operate as they see fit. The next slide is already up there. Positives of a quota management system. From a biological perspective, the quota management system does pass the test. After interviewing the processors, the government, and the fishermen, the consensus is that the fish stocks are better managed with a quota management system. Everybody seemed to agree on that. They still have stocks that have a lot of problems. You know, it's not to say that everything is perfect, but in general, things are much better than they were 20 years ago. And everybody agreed on that. Approximately 80% of the stocks are rebuilt, with another 20% under a rebuilding plan. And in a rebuilding plan, in this case, it's a very informal rebuilding plan. It's not a 10-year rebuilding plan. It's just basically things have to get better every year. There's no set percentages or anything like that. So, for example, they did have some stocks that are under 100-year rebuilding plans. Some orange roughy stocks are currently, I think, at 3% of BMSY and are projected not to rebuild for 100 years. But that's acceptable under this system. Stewardship. Those that remained in the fishery have seemed to develop a higher level of stewardship. In many occasions, stakeholders have asked to close large areas of critical habitat and make them marine protected areas. A lot of the people we talked to were very interested in stewardship issues. Again, this is a purely economic system, and they have a huge economic stake in it, and they felt that their economic advantage would be in making sure that they continued to have something to work with. Quotas, in some cases, stakeholders have asked that the set quota by the Minister of Fisheries be cut dramatically in order to rebuild the stocks faster. We talked to several people in several of the fisheries who felt that if they rebuilt their stocks faster, that they'd have more to harvest and they'd make more money, and they were willing to take the short-term hit for the long-term gain. You want to take over, Ronnie?
Okay, thank you. I just want to point out one thing. David was talking about the instant fines. Well, they let us into New Zealand free. They wouldn't let us out unless we paid $25. So. Okay, some of the negatives of quota management system. QMS is purely an economic model. Social interests are overlooked. Capitalism doesn't consider mom-and-pop operations as they are considered inefficient. Profitability is the only measuring stick used. New Zealand claimed that it did not have fishing communities. Instead, the communities had fishing in them. If consolidation eliminated fishing from the community, it was just a casualty of business. Now, this is the feeling we got from most of the fishermen we talked to. The public did not benefit from having increased fish stocks. The average public did not seem to benefit out of it. It was just the companies or the processors seemed to be the better, bigger beneficiaries of that. General response we got was that the public could not afford to buy fish at the local market on a daily basis like they here, because most of the fish was exported and they would have to compete with those high export market prices. This is the same thing. Most people we spoke only ate fish either by catching it themselves or on occasional trips to a restaurant. Okay. The system does work for fish, but it comes at a high price for the community, infrastructure, fishermen, and the general public. It promotes sustainability for fish and at the same time eliminates fishermen and small processors and infrastructure. Biggest downfall of New Zealand quota management system is that it eliminated small boat independent owner operations. The feeling is that it's easier for government to deal with a few large companies rather than a lot of small individual owner-operated operations. New Zealand exports 90% of the fish at high prices. The domestic market reflects export prices, which makes fish unaffordable to most citizens. In New Zealand, whole fishing communities were eliminated with this system. Next slide. Are we on there? Yeah. Consolidation was rapid. Initially, fishermen sold out to companies with capital. With only four major companies to sell fish to, either bring their fish quota to a company to find themselves a lesser market value, since there were only a few independent companies. After 20 years, a high level of bitterness still remains between those who sold out and those that remained in the fishery. The fishermen that remained in the fishery felt as though they got a raw deal. There was anger and bitterness towards the Maori Indians that the fact that they received a high amount of quota for cash and now own a major company with and entitled 20% of any new species that comes under a quota management system. They automatically get 20%. Anything that comes under a new quota management system, the Maoris automatically get 20% off the top. There was a huge battle brewing between the commercial and recreational fishery. Initial allocations did not consider or include the ever-growing recreational sector. They were pushed to stabilize the fishery, but recreational representatives were adamantly opposed. Fishermen feel like hired hands. The fishermen that stayed in the fishery and worked for the fishing processors feel like they're hired hands. They no longer feel as though they have a share or a stakeholder interest in the business. Fishing corporations lured independent quota holders by matching quota one-to-one with a 15% fee on the company quota. So if I had 100 tons of fish and a company had another 100 ton of fish, I would go lease their quota, go fish, and then pay them an extra 15% on their 100 tons. bycatch was hard to deal with in a quota management system, as it is in any system. New Zealand does not have hard tax on bycatch as long as there is enough quota to balance out at the end of the fishing industry, the end of the fishing year. New Zealand does not appear to have fishing shutdowns. When quota is reached by bycatch levels, it becomes the next bullet. What becomes of the boats in the quota management creates value that is associated with permits. The boat becomes less valuable commodity, especially if there's a small or medium-sized boat. The permit has more value than the boat. We have this here, abandoned boats. Plans must be made to dispose of unwanted fishing vessels, or else they will lay at the piers, mooring, cluttering up, and become a hazard and liability to the harvest. Okay.
And this last slide of text is basically discussion points that were presented to us in a summary day. Basically, these are points that the people in the New Zealand Minister of Fisheries felt should be discussed in the United States before adopting this system. In New Zealand, some of these points were discussed, some of them weren't, some of them they really wish they had discussed. So this is probably the key points to take away from this presentation. You need to have a discussion of the privatization of the resource. They did not have that in New Zealand. They basically just did it without any public input. And they kind of wish that they had some discussion at first because they basically you know, now the resource is very much consolidated in the hands of a few individuals, and they think there should have been some public discussion about that in hindsight. The issue of resource rentals as it applies to the issuing of initial quota. Again, the government just stepped in and did it. They didn't take any public input. There wasn't any discussion with the industry about what the resource rents might be. It was just, here's the plan. You know, this is what's going to happen. Again, they think that there should be those discussions. A discussion about the long-term consequences of a quota management system. Again, they were under the gun. They didn't have the luxury of thinking long-term. They just went in and did it. And, you know, now that, you know, if 20 years is considered long-term, that's a matter of discussion probably. But they wish they kind of put out there what they hope things might look like in 20 years and had some of those discussions. The actual design details of the system. They designed a system. They've generally stuck with it. The design details are very complicated. This isn't a simple system any more than Days at Sea or any other system is simple. They still have a number of input controls, a lot of which they implemented after the initial quota management system. They found that they couldn't just do it on quota. They, as an example, they still have minimum size limits. They have, like, no taking of female lobsters between certain sizes. They couldn't just let people take all the lobsters. It just didn't work. So those are the types of details that have to be discussed. A discussion of the theory of an IFQ system versus the reality of its implementation. And in this case, that refers to absolute versus proportional quotas. Initially, they went with an absolute quota system, which means that every fisherman got something based on his catch history, and it was absolute. A proportional system is you get an initial allocation, but it's proportional to the quota that's allowed to be caught in future years. Under this absolute system, the government of New Zealand spent a huge amount of money buying quota back from people when they had to reduce the quota allocations. And there were huge arguments. I mean, people said, you're not paying me what my quota's worth. Other people felt they were paying too much. So they ended up going to this proportional system, and that's where a lot of this bitterness that we encountered came from, is that now the people that got some of their quota bought out don't feel they got enough money for it. The people that now operate under the proportional system feel that they don't have any say anymore. The quota goes down. They don't get anything for their lost quota. They've paid enormous amounts of money for some of this quota. And, you know, it basically is like a stock market. It rises or shrinks in value, and they can't control it. Initial allocation of quota, including an appeals process. This was one they really stressed to us. It's hard enough to issue the initial quota. That's an enormous battle in itself. But their appeals process was very liberal, and they really wish it hadn't been. They ended up with what they felt was a lot of people who got in through the back door what they couldn't get in through the front door because they didn't set it up well enough initially. So that was a recommendation to us that we have a very strict appeals process that was enforceable. Allocation between commercial and recreational sectors. They didn't do this. Their recreational fisheries weren't large at the time of implementation of this. They fervently wish they had done it because they now have a situation where in some fisheries, the assumed recreational catch, they don't know what it is, but it may be as much as 50% of the total, and they have no way of accounting for it. And so what they basically do is they assume, let's use red snapper because that seemed to be the one that was most cited. They'll take and assume that the recreational catch is 50%, and if that's up from 40% last year, then they take 10% of the quota from the commercial sector away from them and just give it to the recreational sector. And so you can just imagine how this leads to animosity between groups. In New Zealand, it's considered apparently a right to be able to just go fishing. Everybody's got a right to get out of the shore and toss a line in the water. There's no license fees. There's no permits. There's no nothing. You want to get a lobster? put on your diving suit, go out and get yourself a couple lobsters for dinner. As long as you don't sell them, you're all set. You sell 1 ounce of fish, the guy shows up and asks for $250,000. But as long as you eat it yourself, you're all set. Spatial issues. This is something they're just dealing with now, this whole issue of ocean zoning. Again, it wasn't an issue 20 years ago, but they wish that they had dealt with it before it became an issue, because now they're dealing with it much like we are in the United States on a piecemeal basis. They're trying to divide up the ocean between agriculture and marine protected areas, and they don't have much oil and gas, but, you know, that would be something more for this area. All the issues of ocean zoning, they're trying to deal with the same as we are. Rebuilding schedules versus quota governance, and they did discuss this with us some, the idea that the Magnuson Act would have to be rewritten to use their type of system, that we have a number of specific codes in the Magnuson Act that would not allow us to do a number of things that they do. It is a very different governance system. It would require a different Fisheries Act than we currently have. So that's a summary of the text, and we got a few pictures for people who want to see some of the things that New Zealand looks like. I'd just like to mention one final thing. I know Craig, is Craig still here? I can't see, but Craig was here earlier. If anybody has any questions, they're welcome to talk to Craig as well, Craig Pendleton. He put quite a bit of effort into helping develop this presentation, as did everybody. Rodney's the principal technical genius behind it. I'm just the mouthpiece. And we'll be happy to take any questions that you have.
Okay. Are there any questions of quite an informative presentation there? Okay, Jim?
Yeah, Dave, the first time you spoke, you said they don't discard anything. They bring it all in. And then the second time you spoke, you said there were some size limits. Could you explain that?
Yeah. Yeah, it actually, that's kind of a dichotomy. They do have size limits, and those fish are discarded, the fish below a minimum size. But if you go out and, I mean, I'll just cite an American example. Let's say you make a tow and you get 1,000 pounds of cod. You bring in 1,000 pounds. If you're only allowed 600, you have to buy 400 pounds of quota from somebody. And in the case of, or another case, let's say you have a big tow of spiny dogfish, and you're a small boat like me, and you get a 30,000-pound tow, and your boat only holds 10,000. If you get caught dumping those fish, you get a $250,000 immediate fine. You have to tow the 30,000 pounds of fish home and unload them, and then you've got to buy dogfish quota to balance out whatever. So if the dogfish, say you had 600 pounds of dogfish quota and you got 30,000 pound tow, you've got to buy 29,400 pounds worth of dogfish quota. So it can get real expensive real quick if you make a mistake and your neighbors aren't very friendly and they don't want to sell you some quota at a reasonable price.
Hey, David, you made a number of references to stewardship and how the positives of a quota management system involves stewardship. With your reference to marine protected areas, you indicate that there was, on many occasions, stakeholders requested large areas to be closed. Could you better describe that stewardship aspect of the New Zealand management system? Is it really, in your mind, was it really a very significant, very obvious stewardship initiative involving, for example, many large areas closed as marine protected areas?
They have an enormous area that they've closed. Coincidentally, most of it's unfishable under current technology. This is a difficult question because it was hard for me to separate out very shrewd business sense. You know, get out in front of a problem, give something that you can't use anyway, versus this aspect of a real belief in stewardship. I did encounter a real belief in stewardship among a number of, most of the people we talked to were either the heads of these corporations or people very high up in the corporation. I did sense that that sense of stewardship was genuine, that they do care about their environment. They do care about the future of their fisheries. They care about it for a number of reasons. Their primary care, this is a purely economic model, and they care about it for purely economic reasons. They know if they don't have a good stewardship program, they'll lose money. But we did also detect from some of the smaller people that Roddy and I went out to and talked to on the dock, people who weren't involved with these big corporations, a sense of even having a very small amount of quota. The few people that are left that are still quasi-independent operators had a strong sense that they wanted to do the right thing.
Can I elaborate on that just a little bit? Yeah, many of the fishermen we talk – well, I shouldn't say fishermen, the processors we talk to, the science advice they would get would be to set a quota at, say, 100 metric ton. As managers, they would come in and – they'd go back and give them counter advice, and they'd want that set at 75 or 80 metric ton just to rebuild their fishery even faster. We sense that a lot. And as far as the marine protected areas, yes, they gave up 30% of their ocean bottom to that, and they were up front to give it. And like David said, most of it was unusable, but it's still a marine protected area. Nobody could use it for anything. We got to go out on one and see it through a glass bottom boat. And it was very, you know, the activity there was very limited to what was happening. You could go out on a glass bottom boat, but there wasn't any private people out in that marine protected area.
Okay. Sally?
Yeah, I had a few questions. The first one is about deemed value. Can you just talk a little bit more about how that's calculated? Is it, I guess I assume that it must be something close to what the ex vessel value of the fish is that's landed up above and beyond what the quota is.
It's a free market thing, so it's between a buyer and a seller. Some people operate at a what I would call maybe a realistic level. You know, if you got to buy 29,600 pounds of dogfish quota, they're not selling it for $100 a pound. But when it gets near the end of a quota and you have a high-value species that's still being harvested and there's a low-value species that's caught as bycatch, the deemed value of that low-value species can greatly exceed the value of the species. And there are a lot of games played. I mean, people extort other people over deemed value. It's an interesting system. It would certainly be, I would have liked to have seen it in actual operation when you were near the end of a quota and interviewed both the guy who was trying to buy and the guy who was selling and tried to determine what their true motivations were. But, you know, that's about all we saw because we only saw a snapshot.
So the deemed value doesn't go to the government or some kind of fisheries fund. It goes to the person who holds the quota that you need.
In that instance, it does. If there's no quota left, it goes to the government. It's kind of like a fine. And then it goes back into the fisheries management process. And that how that loop was closed, I didn't quite understand it. I mean, they reissue that money at some point. They've got a lot of corporations that do this stuff that are one arm's length removed from the corporation that owns the quota. All I can say is it's a very complicated system, and the best thing to do to understand it would be to actually contact MFISH, and if you want to get detailed information on it, have them produce a white paper for you, because it's not something that I can describe in a few minutes.
Under negatives of a quota management system, one of the bullets was profitability is the only measuring stick used.
That's exactly it. This is a purely economic model. We asked numerous times if there were any social considerations of any kind. There are absolutely none. It's purely they measure success in economics. If people, you know, it's all about making money. It's as close to Adam Smith capitalism as anything I've ever seen.
And just one last question. You kind of answered it already, but on the when you have bycatch and you need to find someone else who has the quota that you don't have, you said that there can be that it can be difficult to find that person if you don't get along with your neighbor or something to that effect. Was that something that you saw, that people did have difficulty? If I understand now a little bit better, since you're talking about maybe different times of the year or during the season or when a quota is close to being reached, but was that a difficulty for people to be able to kind of make their balance sheets work?
We were told by some of the people in some of these larger corporations who were both buyers and sellers of deemed value, that a lot of them described it with a wink and a smile as games are played, and then they'd wink at you. So clearly, people are paying in sometimes very much excess dollar value for quota. There are, on a day-to-day basis, in order for you to balance your books, and do you remember how long it was they had to do it?
1 year.
1 year. There are actually these arm's length corporations that deal in the day-to-day marketing of deemed value. They're like clearinghouses. And so you contact them and you say, I need, you know, X amount of whatever fish, and they'll put you in touch with a seller.
Yeah, the way I recollect was, say you fished in 2006, you went over your quota, and you couldn't buy it off any individual in this room. You put it up. The government took that money, held it in escrow for a year. If they could go through a clearinghouse, it sounded like there was some kind of a clearinghouse that would put two buyers together and negotiate a deal with them. You had a year to do it. If not, that money went back to the government.
And one last question. Enforcement. I didn't hear any discussion about enforcement. Was that something that didn't come up? I'm just wondering, just in general terms, if there were good things, bad things that you saw about that?
We didn't actually interview any enforcement agents. We were told enforcement stories by people from MFISH. We never actually talked to the agents themselves. They have much the same enforcement setup that we have here. They have the equivalent of NOAA enforcement agents that are MFISH enforcement, plainclothed and uniformed, to both check on recreational and commercial. We asked about this whole idea of blackfish. You know, what happens when a guy just brings in fish and sells it? Because of the fact that it's an island nation and you've pretty much got to get it off the island, they probably have a leg up on us in that respect. It's not easy to move fish in an illegal market. That being said, they also, as I told you, have this very different legal system where they assess these enormous fines on the spot. They did tell us a story about a case they just had where a guy brought in fish, and they have much the same as we do, the dealer landing slips and this whole huge paper trail that has to be filled out. And somehow he got the fish into the market without all this paperwork, and they figured it out. So they fined him $250,000. They seized his boat because it was involved in the transaction. They seized his pickup truck because that was used to transport the fish. They seized his house because he had his office in his house, and that was part of the transaction. What they didn't seize, and this is the part that we asked about and we still don't understand, is they didn't seize the processor who bought the illegal fish. He got a free pass. To me, in order to have an effective enforcement system, you've got to get both the buyer and the seller. As long as there's a buyer and the buyer has no there's no disincentive for him to buy, why shouldn't he? And in this case, all the disincentive's on the seller, and there's nothing on the buyer.
Okay, Dave, I have one question before I go to the list. Do they have any subsistence fishing? I know 20% comes off the top, and then they get the recreational catch, and if they do have it, is it accounted for, or is it just part of the recreational catch?
No, this subsistence fishing, if you want to call it that, is in that first part of the presentation, the Maori settlement. I mean, they take any of their subsistence fishery out of their quota. But the fact is that we met with the Maoris, and they have a very large corporation, and in terms of absolute percentages, they own, I think it's close to 40. Yeah,
42.
It's a little over 40% of the total quota in New Zealand now. And that's certainly not subsistence fishing. And they hire people to fish their quota for them. These were very, very shrewd businessmen. They're not out there in canoes.
So that's all being sold. But is there any other group that is just subsistence?
No. It's, okay. As I said, it's taken out of their quota if they want to do it. But they're more interested in the money than the subsistence.
Okay. Paul.
David, your first slide, or one of the first ones, about 1986, major economic crisis. And, you know, too many participants. I can imagine there you can draw similarities to where we are today with brownfish, major economic crisis for the last 20 years. And I think we're realizing about a quarter of what we could out of our groundfish fishery in terms of revenues, maybe less than a quarter. So in 86, what was the value of their fishery? And today, what is the value of their fishery?
They never told us any absolute numbers for value. But in this case, the economic crisis wasn't the fisheries crisis. It was actually a government economic crisis. They had a very heavily socialized system of government where the easiest way I can describe it is the game was to get more than you paid. And everybody got a handout from the government. So the fishermen got one, the loggers got one, the farmers got one. Anybody who had any hand in natural resources was getting some kind of a government subsidy. And the idea was to get more out of the system than you paid in taxes. And people were very, very good at doing that. And so the result was that the treasury was being bankrupted. And so the economic crisis wasn't the lost revenue from the fisheries. The fishermen themselves didn't actually care what the revenue was because they were operated under a system where if they didn't catch any fish, the government paid them anyway. So they were everybody was happy except for the people who ran the treasury because they're looking at just a staggering flow of red ink and no way to stem it.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I thought it was a very interesting presentation, guys. Two things kind of jumped out at me. Number one, the fees that are penalties that they pay or are assessed to them means that these guys are making a lot of money on their product and able to pay the those types of fees. Is $250 and plus the actual amounts that they pay, or do they kind of wind up like the U.S. and get assessed something, and then it's a fractional, sometimes a fractional amount of that, or do they pay the whole amount?
Well, what we were led to believe is they go out of business.
Right.
There's not three strikes you're out or anything like that. The $250 alone usually whacks out most people. In these big corporations, they keep the quota at arm's length, so it's not like you're attaching the corporation for the $250. So you might have, you know, the quota in this little private company, this little corporation, and you can basically wipe out that corporation with a fine or something. But it's designed to get the small independent guys or the individual boat that's working for the large corporation that violates the law. And $250 generally cleans out that aspect of it. The boat's gone, the quota's gone, everything's gone. And then the quota gets reissued in an auction process.
Okay, my second question, or the second thing that kind of jumped out at me was, you said that the product really wasn't sold domestically. That the folks living there really couldn't afford to buy fish. So taking a species that might be common in that area, and I don't know what it would be, but let's use, in our area, haddock is a reasonably abundant fish. What would be the price that comparable species over there would be going for that these people can't afford it.
Next week.
We had to do, what, kilos per New Zealand dollar, and we had to convert that to pounds per U.S. dollar. But let's say red snapper might be roughly equivalent to haddock, and it was on the order of $10 to $12 a pound at the auction level.
So I guess one of the drawbacks then is that you potentially won't have fresh fish on the market for the local consumers.
Yeah, they had some fresh fish. They generally had I'm not going to say lower quality fish, but maybe fish that doesn't taste quite as good. The markets had fish in them, but it was not the stuff. One of the people explained it to us. They said, we grow the world's best lamb, but all we eat is mutton. We have some of the world's best fish, and all we eat is the junk. That's all we can afford. And that seemed to sum it up pretty well. That was how a local described it to us. I mean, I tried to buy fresh fish when we went out to eat a couple of nights, and you couldn't get it. You went in, you said, I'd like to get a piece of snapper. They said, we don't carry that. I said, well, why not? You catch a great snapper. People can't afford it. We'd have to charge you $55 for a plate of food to have a small fillet of snapper on it, and they can't afford that.
Yeah, it sounded like the locals got the scraps. You know, they got the ling, the whiting, the dogfish, and the haddock and the cod and the flounder got exported. That's what it basically sounded. And going back to the fines, that's basically it. You messed up once, and you wasn't in business, unless you was a big corporation, and they were away from you, and you had a lot of quota, you had access to other quota. But it was basically you know, if you messed up, once you did something, you violated, you was out of business.
So, David, do you think the quota management system then led to the public only eating the mutton? Or do you think that if it was a regular day at sea fishery or something like that, do you think they'd be eating mutton? Or would the fishermen be more likely not to take the higher cost for their product from someone else and give it to the local dealer for less? I don't understand the parallel between a market system and eating mutton.
I guess what I want to say there is that the corporations determine where the fish goes. And so if they've got a contract to fulfill in a foreign country, they don't care what local people might be willing to pay for it. They own the fish, and they've got a contract, and they've got to fulfill it or face a penalty. So you've lost that free market aspect of the fish moving into the local markets. As you see, everything's controlled by a few very large companies. They can set the price in New Zealand as well as overseas. And so I don't think it's strictly a function of the quota management system that New Zealanders can't get fresh fish, but it has made the problem worse.
A couple of questions. I see one thing here, and it says that approximately 80% of the stocks are rebuilt. Is that by volume or by number of stocks? Because I know there's two or three major stocks that support the industry, quote unquote, and those stocks are in poor shape.
Right, it's by numbers. By number, they have 66 or 63 species in the quota management system at the moment. So it's 80% of those 63 species, not 80% of the pounds or anything like that. And as I said, they do have a couple of their orange roughy stocks are in abysmal shape. One of them, I think it was the Channel Islands, they told us was at 3% of BMSY and was not projected to rebuild for 100 years, if at all.
Yeah, and a couple of follow-ups, too. And one was that I know that the Orange Roughy and the Hokie stocks collapsed under this system a couple of years ago. So, you know, if it's such a good system, how could those stocks collapse?
As I said, the ultimate setting of the quota is a political action, It's set by the Minister of Fisheries, who is an elected member of Parliament. He can be unelected just the same as he can be elected. And so there is no formal rebuilding schedule. There is no that's the political aspect of this system. You don't set a quota that's so low that you drive your major, as an example, perhaps drive your major quota holders out of business. They'll campaign against you and perhaps get somebody else elected to Parliament to set a quota that's more in line with their way of thinking. So the system itself, as it's designed, doesn't end overfishing by itself.
Two more. Of the four large companies, do you know if how many of those are publicly traded?
Three of them, I'm sure of. Is the Maori company public? No. The Maori company is privately held, but the other three are publicly traded corporations.
So there could be worries about a stock market collapse if you collapse the quotas.
Yeah, there could be two stock market collapses, the fish stock and the economic stock market. These are publicly traded corporations. They have to answer to shareholders. And they produce annual reports, which actually I have copies of them at home. I could bring them in and leave them with the staff. They're very much like General Motors or Chrysler or Ford or whatever. And the same with the people that run these corporations. They're appointed by a board of directors, and the board of directors is at some level accountable to shareholders. And if they don't manage the assets of the company, which in this case are oftentimes mainly the quota, then they're out as an economic quota casualty of the quota management system as well, looking for a new line of work.
Just a comment to you. I was recently in Iceland, and I followed their quota system, and they have the same type of clearinghouse, only it's a little bit different. If you catch more than your quota, you bring it in. There's no discard rule in Iceland, and then you can't go back out unless you buy enough quota to fill the shortfall that you had through a clearinghouse that they've established of private people. So it's similar to this, but a little bit better, I think. It's an immediate, you got to clear it, yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the things that some of the newer systems have basically built on New Zealand's, I want to say their mistakes, because I'm not sure they were. Anybody who's designing a new system can't know what its mistakes are until it puts it into effect. But even the people in New Zealand have said, they told us numerous times, there's a lot of things, if we had a do-over or a mulligan, whatever you want to call it, that we would have changed. But in some balance, wouldn't you say they felt that they were going to probably pretty much stick with things the way they are, that they weren't going to go back and do any wholesale changes?
Yeah, one of the messages we got is they wish they had more time to think about it before they put it in effect. They kind of rushed into it. And once they made their decision, they stuck with it. And that we got that comment from several people.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good presentation by you fellows there. It looks like you did your homework. And, of course, Rodney's hard to beat when it comes to cameras and technology. I got a dose of that myself. It amazes me. Used to couldn't tie his shoes, but now he does a great job, you know. But what strikes me about this and this, what you didn't include in this, and it was no reason for you to, is the history. If you follow this through Fishing News International, the parallel to New Zealand's fishery and the Alaska pollock fishery are unprecedented. They're right down the same track. And you know what's the driving force? Norwegian technology. The seamount fishery for orange roughy and hoki and Oreo dory was created by the Norwegians. They were bringing in vessels from Norway to fish that fishery as they were developing it. The reason they support science financially now is the science was so far behind where the industry was with fishing that the only way they could allow themselves could satisfy the need for science was to fund it themselves, get it out there. But they were so far behind, and this is all documented. If you look back in Fishing News International, every damn bit of it is there. This pertains mainly to the offshore fisheries. But like you say, it's consolidated now. I'm looking at Sea Lord stuff. I watched them. Kyle Roke from American Seafoods had money in Sea Lord, and he is by far the one of the richest men in the world, and he doesn't have anything to do with fishing anymore. He's running Caverna Shipyard in Philadelphia is Roki. This guy started out as a deckhand on a Pollock boat in the early 1980s in Alaska. I mean, it's just a Cinderella story. But the fact is, the need for science couldn't be met through the traditional channels, so the industry jumped ahead and provided it, but the technology was always a step ahead of it. That's why it collapsed. That's why it collapsed. They couldn't do the science as quick as they could catch the fish. And orange roughy is a very slow-growing fish. I mean, and it had no value because that's another marketing trick. They were called slime heads. Until they changed the name to orange roughy, you couldn't sell them. You know, and I'm serious. That was a marketing issue. But it was a fish that was not easily handled well, so at-sea processing became an issue. And, again, the technology of the Alaskan pollock fishery and all. So when you look back in the long term, you see about an 8 to 10 year difference in Alaskan pollock and New Zealand coming up. And if you look at the value of those fisheries over those years, you can see that the main value shifted to the offshore sectors, which is exactly what happened with pollock. I mean, how many Alaskan Eskimos you know that land pollock? Now they got millions of tons of quota to a tribe. You know, the biggest boat they got is a small John Paparaldo's longliner, and it's a canoe. You know, so there's a lot of parallels there, but I think the industry was put in a position where they had to make some very significant changes, and they were just like Alaska, they were behind the eight ball, always a step behind. The collapse was already taking place before it was recognized, and the problem now is the offshore sector with the Hokie and the orange roughy. They're the only ones ever allocated that resource anyway. The traditional fishermen around the island never even bothered with them. And there is the money fish. You know, there is the high-dollar fish. So they're automatically eliminated from that. It was only the bigger companies that could put forward it. So there's lessons to be learned from it. And the last thing is, am I correct? Was it New Zealand that burned the poaches? They had 10 to 12 boats rafted together and torched them off there in the last 6 months? I mean, good big boats, 80, 90, 100-foot boats. Was it New Zealand or Australia? I think so, too. So they're serious about their regulations.
Yeah, just when you get back to the science, as you were going to the science, we didn't put it in this presentation, but when the science was operated, the data collection was operated by the government, they employed 800 people, and it took them 8 years to get the results out of the scientific collection. When it privatized, they went to 180 people, and they could get the results in 2 months.
Another
no thing, slap to the science.
Another thing we ought to mention, too, and I didn't think of it till Jim just brought it to my attention, is they do allow foreign fishing on their quota. So Sea Lord is an example. If it doesn't have the boats to catch all the quota it's bought, it can bring in foreign ships and harvest it and process it. And, I mean, a lot of things you can't do here. And one of the questions they asked us, because they did have questions for us quite a bit too, was how come you don't allow us to buy your quota? Specifically, they were very interested in the New Bedford scallop fleet. The guy said, I came over here. He said, I was prepared to buy the entire scallop fleet in one shot. He said, why won't you let us do that? What's the matter with you people? You know, I could have bought the whole scallop fleet in New Bedford in 3 or 4 days. And I got there and found out that you don't allow, you know, foreigners to own your fishery. So, again, it's a very different system.
Okay, Rip.
Thank you. I, too, want to thank Rodney and David. This has been an interesting presentation. I think it's stimulated a lot of comments and a lot of thought about this. And it seems to me that it would be beneficial for us at some point in time in the not-too-distant future to either set a day aside at a council meeting or set up another day, and maybe we could get some other presentations from IFQ systems here in the U.S. And spend the day talking about some more of this. I think it would be very beneficial.
You know, was wondering if there was any requirement to for a boat before it goes out to have a certain amount of quota, anticipating bycatch, you know, say 20% of cod when you're after haddock, anything like that to prevent overfishing?
No.
No. I mean, if you've got 1 pound of cod quota, you can't leave the dock if you don't have any. But if you've got 1 pound of cod quota and you've got 1 million pounds of haddock quota, you can go out and harvest your 1 million pounds of haddock quota, and whatever cod you catch, you either buy deemed value from some guy who has cod quota, or you pay the government the deemed value. But yeah, there's no prohibition on continuing to fish.
And that hasn't led to perennial overfishing, that we're always, you know, we've got 110% of the quota and we're buying that last 10% from the government?
We had a hard time determining that. We did ask quite a bit. The one that comes to mind is red snapper, because that seems to be the one they were having. It's a near shore species and, you know, a lot of easy access. They seem to be having problems with that. But they couldn't specifically cite any time that a fishery shut down when, even if they over-harvested. What their solution was basically to take it off the next year. But there's no prescribed amount they had to take off. And in the case of red snapper, where it was a politically very powerful symbol, you know, because about 50%, as best they could tell, was harvested by the recreational fishery, they were having some very serious discussions. by discussions, I mean arguments over what to do, because reducing it to 10 to 20%, which seemed to be their usual method of dealing with an overfished stock, was not coming close to solving their current problems. That they reduce it, recreational catch went up, things got worse. Red snapper are harvested by a number of other fisheries in an ancillary basis, and they couldn't balance the books no matter what they did. So, excuse me.
That's all I have on the list. I think that's about everybody anyway.
Actually, there was a big fight between recreational and commercial fishermen. We sat at a meeting similar to this, and they were not friendly. Recreational wanted their own quota, and there was no quota to give them. Basically, that's what they wanted. That's the take I got out of it, right? Is that what you got?
Yeah. I mean, they were trying to do what we've had a little discussion about here in the past, is in some kind of percentage would be allocated to the fisheries, and they would then figure out how to manage it amongst themselves. And best we could tell, at least at the particular meeting we attended, in which there are four major parties. There's the commercial, the recreational, the Maori, and the government. And as best we could tell, the recreational people in New Zealand felt that they had a right to catch as much as they wanted, whenever they wanted. They weren't willing to give an inch on that subject. But they would take a quota that gave them, that would be the quota they wanted, not you get X percentage. It's, you know, we get whatever we need. The commercial people were the ones who were given all the time, and some of them were given quite a bit in terms of dollars. They bought all this quota in the last 20 years, and now they're just having it taken away piecemeal. Naturally, they're not very happy. And the ones who were kind of like the brokers of the whole setup were the Maori Indians, who were sitting at the table saying, okay, we'll, and they're very skilled negotiators as a group of people. And they sit there and they say, well, we'll negotiate a deal with both of you. And somehow I suspected that the ones who are going to win in the end are the Maori. They're going to get it all, both recreational and commercial, because they're probably the best negotiators. And this is basically a big, complicated, negotiated settlement.
Okay, I think that wraps that up before we break. Audience, Jim?
Don't worry, I'm not homesteading. One thing that I thought was very interesting was that said the fishermen that remained feel as though they got a raw deal. In most systems, it's the complaint that you hear from fishermen is that they got out too early and sold out too cheap. And could you elaborate on that a little bit?
My take on it, Dr. Pern, and David could correct me if I'm wrong, the fishermen, the companies that went to the fishermen and first sold out for a high price. The fishermen that stayed, remained with quota, didn't have enough quotas to survive, so they had to go make a deal with the companies to survive. So now they're under the thumb of the companies, the larger companies. They get their additional quota or their deemed value from these companies. And they, what was it, $33 down to $15 for red snapper?
Yeah.
One fisherman, we went, actually, when we first got to New Zealand, we took about an hour's nap, and David and I walked down the dock. And I think that was the best information we got was that first 45 minutes sitting in that guy's wheelhouse. And he said before this system went into effect, he used to get, I believe it was $30 or $35 a kilo for orange red snapper. And now it was down to $15, just about half price.
So half the X value was going in rental, in effect? Okay, thanks. And if I may, just one more. New Zealand's got maybe 4 or 5 million people, maybe six. And so, you know, the population is half in New York City. And although they have a large EEZ, I think the shelf is rather small. And what I'm trying to get at is whether or not we've got a comparable situation from which we can really draw a lot of lessons. Because the greatest value is really in fisheries that aren't pursuable by an owner-operator. You need a big boat, something that can go fly a net down the side of a seamount, and if you lose the net and it's $100,000, well, that's just the cost of doing business. In view of that, do you think what came out of New Zealand is useful for fishery management here on other than a very general basis in the Northeast? I'm just looking for a gut reaction.
Well, first of all, as to species complex and geography and everything, they are in south latitude, we are in north latitude. That being said, they do not have the temperate ecosystem that we have. They have far fewer species. They don't produce nearly the volume of fish. In other words, their biomasses on some of these fish aren't nearly as large as similar temperate water species might be in the northern latitudes. So in that respect, you can't compare the ecosystems because they are very different. New Zealand is geologically and geographically isolated, and it's almost developed its own ecosystem. To the idea of some of their fisheries being distant water fisheries, yes, their fisheries extend all the way below the Antarctic Circle. You need very large vessels that can stay at sea under extraordinary weather conditions to harvest those species. But their near shore species are, I would say, similar in a lot of respects to what occurs from maybe Virginia to the northern part of Florida. They're kind of a cross between temperate and subtropical, mixed species, number of different kinds of reef fish and stuff. And so in a way, yeah, they're not similar to New England per se, at least the ones that we were able to witness. But I'm not sure the management aspects of it vary no matter what the species are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think these presentations have been very useful, and they've accorded with what I knew beforehand of events in New Zealand, but I wanted to add a couple more details, and then I thought ask a different question, but it may be Jim O'Malley's question asked a different way.
As some people in the room know, I worked for the government of Australia in the mid-80s, and we watched the development of this system across the Tasman Sea rather carefully. Australia had started down the ITQ road before New Zealand did, but didn't go anywhere near so far. And in 87, I was part of a delegation from Canberra that went over to Wellington to try to see what they were doing and how it was going. It's all a long time ago now, but gave me a bit of an introduction to the earlier history. One of the things with New Zealand was before the 200-mile limit, it hardly had a fishery at all. The inshore New Zealand fisheries were very, very small scale, very sort of local supply, rock lobsters, that kind of stuff, but not the high-volume lobster that we have in New England. When they got the 200-mile limit, they suddenly got this huge EEZ. Deep water, offshore, southern ocean kind of stuff. And as was just said, it needed big factory ships. They basically took over the British fleet that had been kicked out of Iceland and Greenland and so forth. Big boats went down there, started fishing for big corporations. When they first went ITQ, it was those big boat offshore corporate-owned fisheries. And as we would expect, an ITQ management system worked well for that kind of a fishery. The observation we had from 2,000 miles away in Australia was that New Zealand went too far when they went on a sort of one-size-fits-all. ITQs work for offshore corporations, so they were going to impose them on things like the red snapper fishery and the other inshore fisheries. So my question to Rodney and Dave is, did you get any of that feeling while you were there, that this was a system that worked for certain kinds of fisheries and not others? Or after 20 years, does it begin to look like it works for all of them equally well and equally badly?
We went to a local pub, and just what you said, I got the same echo. It works for the larger offshore fleet. It did not work for the individual operator, the one, two-man boats. Matter of fact, when we was at the pub, there was a guy negotiating to sell his boat. That was his last day of fishing. And they were the ones that were really dissatisfied with the small boats, the 30, 40-foot boats.
Thank you.
Okay. That wraps that up, I think. So, thank you for that presentation. Oh, Rodney?
Yeah, I've got 8 or 9 CDs with photos. I'll give them to the council. They'll be yours to use whatever way you want.
Okay. Very good. All right, that wraps that up. Pat, you have additional?
Good. I had one more announcement. We filed today an emergency action for the scallop fishery that established an improved observer service provider program. What this will do is effectively allow observers to be certified to provide observers, approved and certified to be provide observers in the scallop fishery. This is going to allow us to reactivate the industry-funded portion of the scallop program. So it's filed today. We'll publish on June 16th, and we hope to be able to deploy observers in the scallop fishery through this within a week or two after that. And I'd like to do this again tomorrow when the scallop industry is here.
Okay, very good. With that, we're adjourned for today. We'll start up tomorrow morning with scallops at 8:30.